I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, hey, leavers and believers. Welcome back to Leaving Hillsong. My name's Tanya, and this is part two of An Insignificant Gay Kid with Sarah from sunny Scotland. And I've got to tell you, it's a pretty uncensored and varied conversation that we have. So once again, content warning four. There will again be a non-swearing version available probably from about tomorrow. More on top of this now. And we really do cover a lot of topics in this conversation, including purity culture, sexual assault, rape in marriage, and gay conversion therapy, eating disorders, and a whole lot of kind of just basic blasphemy that, if you're not a diehard atheist, might be difficult. In any case, you have been warned. I love this conversation, and I think it's really important from a bunch of perspectives that we haven't had with the other two in Pride Month. So let's jump on into part two of An Insignificant Gay Kid.
All the experiences I've had, it's like almost everyone could be delved into. But the marriage, though, yeah, that, I mean, it's something I don't visit that often, think about, but it was so tied up with church culture. This is why it was so toxic. And in a way, not to give him any sort of like forgiveness for what he did, he was a victim to it as well. Like, he was actually raised in that Christian Outreach Centre church, and his whole family, like, none of them were vaccinated. Like, they were all like, you know.
Church seems to be so tied up into everything, even when you are leaving. Did it all sort of happen at once, the marriage breakdown, the...
Optically, but in reality, that marriage should never have happened in the first place. I was too young. I was in an environment where if a young couple starts going out, the whole church is like, oh, God's told me that this is the one for you. Oh. Also, because you're raised in purity culture and you've prayed all your life that when I meet someone, it's going to be the one and they're going to take my virginity and it's going to be great. It's almost like you're fed this almost like Quiverful-esque purity culture thing. So there's that, and you believe in God, and I believe that, like, oh well, God must have brought me this person, and this is maybe my way out of, you know, being an insignificant gay kid. You know, it was not a functional marriage from day one from neither of us. How could any marriage be functional when neither of you have had sex before, for a start? Like, what a stupid concept to not have sex with someone before committing to them legally. It's just absurd. As you can imagine, we were completely sexually incompatible. A lot to do with the fact that, like, I'm gay. But also, yeah, it turned out he lost his job because he was, like, voyeuristically watching women at his work. He got caught one time, but he'd done many, many things. Some of them, before I even married him, I knew about. But because I believed that God forgives these things, everything would be fine, which is another bullshit concept. And I resent the fact that adults were not looking out for me at all. Yeah. Like, my parents were just so caught up in wanting to be a big shot in the church and be a leader that they didn't think for a second that maybe this wasn't a great idea. Or, and for me as well, the to circle back to the de-gaying thing, one of the pivotal things for me was the most committed thing you can do in a church is a 40-day fast, isn't it? So, yeah. Like, it's the most extreme, like, desperate plea to God. And I, what else can you do other than fast for 40 days? That's like the top dog of, you know, commitment. And when I was about 16, 17, in the space of 1 year, I did 3 40-day fasts.
So what do you mean by fast? So you would have one?
To not eat for 40 days. Not eat.
At all?
At all. Just drink.
Water?
Eat nothing. Yeah, I mean, I had juice and stuff, but not eat at all. And as you can imagine, the effects for me was that ever since that, not only was I so disappointed that I still was gay, I just had struggled with eating disorders the rest of my life, because obviously you're 16, you're a female, like, you know, I should have had an adult saying, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea. But instead, it was looked at as like, oh my God, Sarah's so holy and so, you know, into Jesus or whatnot. And I'm like, I'm just trying to change myself. But the reality is, it's psychologically damaging. And then, yeah, so did 3 40-day fast, and all I got was this stupid persistent eating disorder. Not even a t-shirt. I've seen preachers even who, you know, they get booked to preach at the church because they're so anointed because they've done these 40-day fasts and everyone looks up to them, you know. And I just look at them, I'm just like, you're a grown man who's bulimic, you know. It does get like, what the reason I fasted was, I was like, I want to change. And you know what, it did change me. It did not change me in the way that I wanted it. It is life-changing to deprive your body of food like that at such a young age. And I think it almost gives people like a high, like it's a control, it's like a power thing, you know. Prophets love doing that, don't they? Prophets in church love fasting. It's a power thing, and it's also to lord over people and be like, I'm more spiritual than you because I don't eat, you know. It's absurd when you think about it. But
because it's not a 3-day fast, 40 days would have to have effects on the brain and development.
Oh, yeah, it's psychologically
trigger you into altering. Eating disordered eating behavior.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to be like, 6 days you fast. You know, it's and 3 times back to back, 6 weeks eating, 6 weeks not eating, six weeks not eating, just to try and not be gay, because that was the one thing that I felt like was holding me from going to heaven. Well, I mean, I could not practice being gay. That was your other option. But I'm not like that. I'm like a normal sexual person.
A human being and stuff.
Yeah. Stuff like that.
How did the church treat you in terms of your ex-husband's offences?
I'm trying to think of a word to describe it. Stupidly. They treated it stupidly. They obviously had no, like, they had no idea. Like, the pastors, you know, they'd grown up within the church. They themselves, like, didn't know any non-Christians. They were just so, it was so myopic. And when it did happen, obviously, at the time, you know, he came home from work, he'd been fired because he'd been caught, he was arrested.
Oh, man.
Okay. Press were sometimes around. I had a baby at the time, and we had a mortgage, and I would just went into complete numb mode. And I was like, you have to get another job. And of course, the church's narrative was to frame it as boys will be boys.
Okay.
And obviously, I got ripped of all my responsibility at church because obviously we're both not worthy.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. So I got ostracized as well. They promised him counseling, which they never did. And that's not what he needed anyway. And firstly, I was praised for being so mature and staying with him. And that's probably the only regret I have in my life, is not leaving him right there and then, because I would have got custody of my child 100%. I wouldn't have had to fight the way I had to. And be dragged through the courts. But I can't do anything about that now, because I was young, I had a baby, I did not have the tools to know how to get out of it. All I knew was, you have to forgive anything of your spouse. So that's what I did. So I got praised for being so mature and just, you know, letting it go. But then also on the side, it was pretty much implied that it's like, the reason he's a sex offender is because you're not a good enough wife, which felt awful also.
Yeah.
Then I partook in a lot of sex I didn't want to have, Oh, and that was the other thing. The church said, if you don't have sex with your husband, demons will come into your home and harass your child.
Wow, where'd they get that from?
I know. So that was really terrifying to me because I was terrified of that because I grew up being scared of demons and Satan. So I was like, honestly, most of my life, I was just like, I just need to somehow try and have sex with him. I just need to try and have sex with him. Mm. Hated it. Had a lot of non-consensual sex because of that. And the whole thing was reinforced by him as a person because he's a pervert.
Okay.
And not in the good sense.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
Nothing, because I'm not slut-shaming perverts. Love those guys. But, also, the church really reinforced it. Not only through the culture of the church, but directly to us. And I think that was a lot of why I ended up pulling away as well. Because I was just like, how can you tell a young woman who has a sex offender husband to just, I think the words were, just lie back and think of England.
Literally.
Which is firstly offensive because I'm Scottish. But just basically like, just let yourself be raped. That was basically the... That was their angle.
Yeah, that's
yeah, what it is. Much.
And did he not pick up on your avoidant kind of signals?
Of course he did, and that made him more angry. And even when I was like, look, I don't know what to do. I'm not straight, and I don't want to do this. I don't want to, there's nothing you can do because you're stuck in a trap of not just your marriage, but the fact that your marriage is part of the cult, you're part of that system. So there's no way to really get out. And that's why I said earlier, I think the only way for me to get out was really to just absolutely self-destruct. And I had to lose everything overnight. I lost every person, a bit of everything. And I lost any money I had trying to, because obviously he dragged me through the courts to say, well, she's a lesbian, so she can't be a mother because gay people can't raise children. Yeah,
but this is only, 16, 17 years ago?
Yeah.
Aren't we over that yet? I mean, seriously?
About 15 years ago. You'd be surprised. People think that in court, when mothers get what they want, it's not true. Because bear in mind that the judges are all old white men. A lot of them are Christian, adjacent even. So it's all about this, family values, morals. But also, they could just be like, well, boys will be boys. But also, the thing that was against me was, why are you bringing this up now, Sarah? Why did you not say at the time? And that's why my biggest regret is not taking him to court and leaving him the second that happened, which is absolutely what I should have done. But I can't dwell on blaming myself in that because I genuinely did not have any tools to do that. I was not raised with the tools to know how to do that. And I had no one. I had no one to rely on. Even my friend that when I did break up with them, I went to stay with her, and when she found out I was gay, she kicked me out. And I had to say, thankfully, I had a studio because I'm an artist, and I had to stay in my studio for days and days because there was nowhere else to go.
A Christian friend?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did your family react?
How do you imagine? Terribly. Terribly. Although I have to say this, right? Coming out as gay was one thing. Because that's like that's like a mental illness or a demon possession. But when I came out as an atheist, that was more of a problem because that's seen as a defiance. It's not seen as what atheism is, which is, I'm not convinced. It's seen as a, I hate God kind of thing. And that actually was worse for them, which is funny because at least being gay, they can make you out to be a victim, be like, oh, well.
Yeah.
You poor soul, you've got same-sex attraction. Good Jesus will help you on that. But if you're like, I don't believe that, you're like, oh, fuck, you're defiant. And that was worse.
And where are things at now? I mean, did they make any progress or?
I actually, I cut off my parents about 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I tried really hard. Well, they're just too far gone, man. They're too far gone. I had one final conversation with them to just glean if there was anything to keep from that relationship.
Yeah,
there just wasn't, and they were neglectful. And the whole thing with my parents is a whole other thing. But it's tied into the church, and they were victims of that. It was becoming not mentally healthy for me to have any contact with them. And since I made that boundary, because I wouldn't let anyone else in my life treat me like that, a friend, anyone, yeah. And I wouldn't treat them like that. So I thought, well, just because you're my parents doesn't mean anything to me, especially when they've not been there for me through the worst times of my life. They were not there. And so, yeah, I cut them off, and I don't regret it for a second. It was a great decision.
That's
hard one, and not one that was easily made, and a very hurtful one, and a lot of grief, but it had to be done.
And things have improved for you since?
In terms of, and I mean, as a partner, it makes me an amazing catch, because there's no in-laws. It's just me. I mean, obviously, I would have loved to have a mother, but what can you do? You don't. It is better. Yeah, it's better for me.
I mean, for all the terrified mothers out there that are listening to that, what do they need to avoid? What do they need to avoid?
Honestly.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you touched on this topic of neglect, which is very, very real. And I wonder so much about all these pastors' kids that are fielded out from babysitter to babysitter. And
same. Yeah. I wonder about that too. And I remember when the pastor's kids in my church, they would just be like, they'd be at church till 2 a.m, sitting up the back. And just like passed around. But I think it's not just to the church. It's combined with the fact that that was our family culture thing as well.
Yeah,
And I don't want mothers to worry that their kids are going to cut them off, because it's something that took me so much time and so much deliberation. And the reason that I had to cut my mother off, I don't give a fuck about my dad, really, because he was just a nothing, really. But no offense, but the reason I had to cut my mother off is because when I was young, we were so close. I was the youngest. I was very close to her. And the reason I had to cut her off is because it was just too painful being with my mother and not having a mother, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That dichotomy of I seek out mothering at every angle. Like, that's truly my favorite thing, is to be mothered. And to be teased with that, you know, to be like, you have a mother, but she's not going to give you what you need, was just too hurtful for me. In a way, it would have been easier if we'd been more distant as a child. But the minute, it really was the pernicious poison of evangelical Christianity that got into them, that made them so ambitious in the church. And they not only neglected all their children, because of my mother's nature, she separated us all out, like me and my siblings, so we couldn't have the support of each other. You know, she would badmouth one to the other, blah, blah, blah. It was just such a poisonous environment. And I'm actually quite a wee sensitive soul. It was too much. You know, it was almost like being teased with having family and not having them, because they think you're demon possessed and they want to degrade you. And they just believe stuff that is just wild, just wildly untrue.
The onus is on you to prove that you can justify life away from the fairy tale.
Yeah, you have to conform, or you're not part of the family. And that's the same as the church, isn't it? I mean, you'll have heard this from many people. It's like, when you do conform and you fit that quite middle class box,
that's great.
You're great. You're part of the family. You know, have a fucking iPhone. You can lead this youth group or whatnot. The minute you stray from it, you're nothing. It's almost worse that they sell you that false hope. Yes. And you see that in Hillsong so much. Like, it would be easier if you were just not really involved in the first place. But it's the way they're like, oh, my God, you know, what a champion. God loves you. And, like, come along to this house group. And
we love you.
We love you so much. And love the sinner, hate the sin. Come in and have fucking, you know, pasta with us or something. And it's false. And I find it just disgusting. It's like, so inauthentic.
Very
It is cruel, and it just rubs up against who I am. I think it's just so, my whole life, it was just so deeply incompatible with the whole thing for whatever reason. And it was just endlessly embarrassing, you know?
Okay, now look, tell us what life's been like since you got out. What kind of advice would you give to someone else, sort of, you know, similar to you in a sitting in a church with those kind of conflicts and not sure. And
the years after I left church, obviously, you know, you're seen as an absolute pariah. But I tell you something, the more you are yourself, years down the line, I can't tell you how many kids from the church have contacted me being like, I think I'm gay, and actually I secretly really respected what you did, and like, have you got any advice? And like, honestly, just being the best authentic version of yourself is the best you can give to everyone around you. Everyone.
And how do you do that? How do you do that?
Well, for me, it's not editing myself. It's continually learning. I think, I don't know if you've maybe heard this from other people, but like, I know I came out of the church with a furious thirst for knowledge to know all the stuff that I didn't get to learn. You know, I was just like, give me every science book I can possibly get. Let me listen to everything. Let me understand what logic and reason is and all these tools that you should have been given as a child. And I wasn't. Yeah. And that was really useful and beneficial to me. People been able to see that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm just myself, and I've taken steps that were quite brave, probably, if I think about it. Not to like big myself up, but yeah, it cost me literally everything. Cost me everything. But it's the one thing I'm so proud of myself for doing, is getting the fuck out of that situation.
Yeah.
And to convey to people that it's like, it's, you know, because people think, oh, you think that now, but you're not really happy. You know, one day you'll come back to the Lord. And it's like, no, I will not. Like, I can't tell you how much lighter, how much kinder, how much more moral the world is outside of that situation. And almost restored some hope in humanity for me, because we were raised to think that everyone who wasn't a Christian, you know, was a baby molesting, you know, cannibal or something, and it's just ridiculous.
And then if you step outside, you'll join them in the...
Yeah, that's right. And then you do step outside and you're like, oh my God, I didn't turn into a rapist. Maybe humans are altruistic by nature, and it's actually the religion that perverts it. But it's been an adventure afterwards. I married the woman who I had an affair with. That turned out to not be a good relationship either. We were together for maybe 9-10 years.
How did you meet her, by the way? I'm interested in how did you kind of raise eyebrows at each other? And
I suppose this is one of the ways I got out of religion, is I'm a musician, and I started playing just secular gigs. Exactly. This is why you're not allowed to, you know, do that. So music, yeah. So it meant I was out in the secular environment, and my ex-wife was a music promoter at the time, and she was putting on a show, and I played, and it just introduced me to musicians, and I made friends with them. Also, I went to art school at the time, so I met people there who were not Christians, and it turned out to be good people too. And it just, you know, you started to realize, you're like, people who are not Christians are not evil. They just believe in a different thing. So yeah, long story short, through music was one of the reasons I stayed in church, because I did it at church, but also it was one of the pathways out of church. And I got a lot of flack for that. You know, I'd get into trouble a lot in church for either questioning or pointing out that something was a bit cringe, or for, you know, being at a pub. But in the last few years that I was there, I almost started doing these experiments at church, right? Where, like, think of Hillsong, right? And the band gets up on stage And it's like, you have to be so pure to have that position, don't you? You have to be really anointed. You know, you pray before you get up on stage. Everyone's really pure. And see if someone's not, you know, the pastor will be like, actually, you've got some sin in your life. You're off. You know, that's happened in my church where there was a guy playing the keyboard and they're like, you've got sin in your life. You need to step down. I don't know what the fuck that was, but I remember turning up to church and I was basically a general dog's body for the band. I would get texts in the morning, what instrument I was playing. I would turn up and I would do it. I played all the roles. And sometimes I would turn up and I'd be like hungover, or I'd be like, I just had sex with somebody last night.
Yeah.
How come you can't tell that straight I'm away. Living a life of sin? And it made me realize, I'm like, this is a performance. I just perform the right thing. And I'm like, oh, shalabada, karabada, you know, and it doesn't fucking matter. And I was like, you guys don't have a fucking clue what you're talking about. I can literally turn up and I can lead worship and everyone after be like, oh my God, Sarah, you're the most anointed worship leader ever. It was so beautiful. And I'm like, What are you on about? It's in the same time. Remember that Michael Guglielmucci, the healer song?
I was just going to say,
That was hilarious. And I remember bursting out laughing in church when I found out that it was fake and getting into trouble for that. But I was like, guys, why did you put so much weight on it in the first place? You know, I just remember looking at everyone.
Was it a big deal in your church? That song?
Oh, yeah. Everything was on Todd Bentley and Todd White. And people, I remember somebody being like, I can't believe you're not going home to watch Todd Bentley. And I'm just like, I just remember looking around me at church being like, is this actually happening? Like, is everyone actually buying this?
Yeah.
I didn't know what else to do other than just pull back and just, I would still go, but I was totally checked out because I couldn't believe that people were just being so gullible and I couldn't understand why people could. And I'm like, guys, you all have access to the same information on the internet. Yeah. What is wrong with you? And then the preacher, Kevin, would come up on stage and sometimes he'd use words that he didn't know the meaning of. And I'd be like, you realize that people in your audience understand the meaning of that word. It's just nonsense. And I couldn't understand why. I'm like, you're just going to get away with this. They've been at university. They've read books.
Yeah, that's quite a common one as well. There was a beautiful photo that I think they've scrubbed off the internet, and it's got probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 of these pastors praying for Mike Guglielmucci. He's got oxygen tanks on and a mask on stage. Yeah. And it's like, not one of them.
Oh.
You know, they know where God wants you to spend your money.
Well, it's funny how they can always discern that, can't they? Mm. They can always discern when you need to sow money and you'll get it back. But they can never discern, you know, it's like Kenneth Copeland cancelling coronavirus 2 years ago. Or do you remember Bethel Church and they tried to raise, that's a sick one. That is so sick. And I don't understand why there's not more repercussions from that. Like the YouTube videos of them singing, oh, Liv, get out of your grave and all that.
It was a great song. Jeez.
Beautiful. Yeah, totally emotive. But in the meantime, that baby's sitting in a fucking morgue.
Yeah, not and the parents, that must sick. Be a living hell. The baby died. I mean, I think the child was, 18 months or so?
Yeah.
And they made these people go for over a week, I think, of praying for the child to be raised from the dead. Under what kind of guide? Honestly, what authority?
Who actually thought that that would happen? We've
and
never
then
seen
it grew, it. And then they made a song on day 3 or 4.
And the thing that disturbs me is that that stuff, that type of sick behavior goes completely unregulated. Why? Yeah. Because it's so common. That's a kind of like overt version of what's happening every day in the church. Disabled people getting preyed on.
Yep.
Grieving people getting preyed on. You know, someone could look at that from the outside and be like, why wasn't somebody fucking arrested? This is common. This is common practice. It's the same emotional bullshit. But at the end of the day, I wonder what are those parents going to be like in 20 years' time? I sincerely hope that they'll be out of it. But they'll be out of it at an age where they'll look back and think, I wasted my life on that. And it's a grief that only people who've been through this cultish system can really understand, I think.
Mm. I mean, as on top of their own very natural grief. And
there's
stories all over of these churches stage managing deaths and funerals and just swooping in and taking over. And I wonder if that didn't happened there? How much joy they kind of had in this whole circus of a thing? I mean,
it's things like that, that it's like the deep offensiveness of the fact that these are the institutions that also want to claim monopoly on compassion and empathy, yes, and charity. And they absolutely have it perverted, like everything that is ethical, they pervert. Yeah, they package it up as, well, oh, well, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways, or whatever cherry-picked thing they want to say to avoid looking at what's actually happening in front of them.
And yeah, nor do they care to kind of go, hey, are we doing the right thing? Does anybody want to maybe check according to best practice, yeah, or recent research or latest science?
I feel like for years in church, that was my stance, was just like, I'd look around and be like, is this what we're actually going to be doing? Like, is this, mm-hmm, are you sure, you know? And obviously that type of attitude, I would just labeled with, well, you know, I'm antagonistic and, you know, a bit of a Jezebel probably at the end of the day, you know, classic. Mm. But I it still baffles me why some people get out, some people stay in. And sometimes I almost wonder if it's something to do with neurotypical people and neurodiverse people.
Keep going, because there is some thinking on that. What do you think?
I don't know. But yeah. I do think that, I mean, I myself am neurodiverse. I'm on the autistic spectrum. And I think that we tend to think clearer. There's no passive aggression. Neurotypical people tend to say stuff and mean something different. And
right. Yes. Make all that normal people conversation about weather and things.
Yeah. This type of church is set up for white, cisgendered, straight, middle class, neurotypical people. And all those aspects, if you're on the outskirts of that, you're not part of the boys' club, which in a way is the thing that gets a lot of us out of it, I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, bittersweet.
There's nothing to relate to. Last week we brought this up as well. There's a huge proportion of people in this community, ex and current, churchgoers on the autism spectrum. It's just comes up time and time again. And I think there's an attraction there to very clear roles and literal black and white thinking, but then
church is not black and white thinking. Like it's black and white. I think it's black and white morally, with they have moral absolutes, but everything is so passive and covert. Like the manipulation is covert. Everything is designed to undermine the psyche, and I just feel like I could see through it. That was the thing that really got me out of it. I felt like I couldn't understand why people couldn't see through the shit the same way I could, you know. Baffled.
You obviously very insightful about the whole thing and very clear in terms of your position. A lot of people have got a lot of sort of, oh, you know, I'd like to allow for this, or that wasn't so bad. But you see things crystal clear. What do you make of your own sort of experience of trauma and what it was like? Because, I mean, you said you lost everything overnight, and how do you pick up the pieces and start a new life? This is what people are terrified of. Like, what kind of life? Sorry, it's been, not that long, really, hey?
Yeah, I mean, I've been out of I feel like I've been out of the church for maybe about 20 years, but I didn't physically leave till I was 27.
Yeah.
But then so much, because of obviously I was young enough as well where I could still develop new relationships, I could learn.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for people who leave Christianity or like Scientology or all these types of cults when they're like in their 60s, and it's like, how do you like what you said earlier, how do you eat an elephant? Like, where do you start? For me, I think I have quite a pragmatic approach to trauma. Like, I acknowledge that there was a lot of really psychologically damaging stuff that happened, but I'm not special. Like, this is what happens to everyone who goes through religious trauma, which is also something that scientifically is still being looked into. I think it's very difficult. This is something that I would love to maybe hear from other of your listeners about, actually, is my relationship to talking therapy, because I find that personally, I mean, I think it's a great study. I think it's very useful for people, but because of my background in church, where you get a lot of sort of faux therapy, don't you? And you get a lot of counselling offered to you.
There's and so much talking,
And also they teach you how to do it. And it's almost like it's really fucked me up for therapy for the rest of my life, because firstly, I go to therapy when people find out 1% of what you've been through, they want to fetishize it and be like, oh, you grew up in a cult. Oh, that's insane. I'm like, I'm not here for you to fetishize this. I just want to know how to live my life better. But then secondly, it's second nature to me to start psychoanalyzing them, because that's what we were taught to do in church, you know?
Okay.
They use these psychotherapeutic techniques, but they don't know that they're doing it. And it's a perverted version of it.
You mean
it's a bit like if you were, you know, like maybe you'd be counseling someone, you'd pray over them and you'd be like, God, show me that you've got this trauma. And what we really need to do is, like, you know, find out from your childhood where that came from. And, you know, things that are therapy adjacent, but they're not therapy. And I'd be really interested to know if there's other ex-Christians like that out there, like me, that I would love to be able to do therapy, but it's so loaded. It's very hard to find a therapist that's a very scientific approach. Like, I had one once that, you know, her Instagram handle was like, namaste. And I was just like, this is not going to work, because any slight hint of superstition or anything that's not completely to do with, like, neurology, I'm out. And I don't know whether that's because I'm neurodiverse, but it's not. It's because I truly only believe in, like, hard science. And anyway, don't know how I got into that, but it's difficult because, yeah, we were talking about trauma. Like, therapy would be great, and I've had it through the years, but I find it really difficult. I find the thing that helps me most with trauma is talking to other ex-Christians.
Yeah.
Connection, yeah, and confiding and you know, creating any sense of community, because for all us ex-Christians, community was the thing that was ripped away from us so quickly. And that in itself is a trauma. Like, I would love to be able to believe that Jesus is real and that I'll go to heaven, but I just can't believe it because it's just completely unbelievable. But it would be nice to be in that box of comfort and sort of smug, happy clappy Christianity where everyone else thinks you're an absolute moron, but you think you're great, you know?
And it's interesting. I mean, that you know, all the different kinds of community that are out there get replaced with this one singular community which doesn't, you know, it doesn't replace all those other things by a long shot.
And to be fair, the church has done community so well for years, because not only are they funded, they also cover up people's, they don't hold anyone accountable. Like, if I was a paedophile, the first place I would fucking go would be church, because I know it sounds crass, but, like, it's true, because I've seen it time and time again. Abuse happens, it gets covered, it gets perpetuated, it happens, it gets covered. It's like, oh, boys will be boys, or it's like, oh, well, they're in sin. It's like a perfect environment for abuse, and that's not going to, like, for anyone to come out of it, it's going to give trauma. So, as I say, I'm not special with my trauma, but I think people who've had that type of trauma, we are very special and individual. And for me, it makes talking therapy problematic. But most of the time, I just have to have a laugh about it and know that most people around me won't even understand it, you know?
Yeah, difficult to describe. Hey, I remember being told quite early on that it's the true believers who suffer the most, because, you know, the ones that really wanted to believe this was all real. And
oh, because I was truly, truly believed it. I was really invested, wanted to do anything I could for Jesus. Like, that's the thing. People think, oh, you're an atheist. Well, you're never proper Christian. It's like, I was more invested than most people I knew. I was proper into it. I know the Bible more than most Christians I know. It's not for a lack of trying. I really tried, but I failed. Thank fuck.
I think that's a great place.
Yes, I don't want your brain to fall apart. I truly understand. It's late at night for you. I'd be dead. Yeah, I feel like this is an overview. If you ever want to talk about anything specific.
Yeah, lovely. That was just amazing, Sarah. Thank you. Thank you so much for being so open. And, and giving us a bit of a holiday away to the other side of the world.
Sunny Scotland. I put on my best international Scottish, which I have to do when I'm traveling. So I'm
beautiful. Lovely.
Hopefully understandable.
And you'll come and talk to us again as we go along, yeah?
Absolutely. Just give me a shout.
Thank you. And bye.
Bye.
And thank you so much to Sarah for
the really deep and honest conversation about this life and what it's like. If you want to leave your comments to get back to her about some of the things we're talking about, that would be really great. If you want to find Sarah's art, where she has really investigated evangelical life, you can find her at sarahjstanley.com, and there's a bunch of websites there with a variety of art, and it's amazing stuff, so check it out. Please remember to share these episodes with anyone that you think will find it helpful, and follow us and subscribe and like and all of that kind of stuff. We'll be back soon with brand new content going in all kinds of different directions that we haven't really explored yet. It's taken a while to try and figure out how to streamline all of the stuff we need to cover and to find people who are ready and well, which is most important. So, until we talk next, just keep leaving Hillsong any way you can. Be kind to each other and be kind to yourselves. This is hard stuff. And we'll talk then. Bye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.